lovely. Thank you very much for coming along to Writ Loud. I'm first, which is a bit scary, but never mind. I'm going to read a story called Jim, which came about through a wonderful group which some of us Birkbeck students have set up together called the Unwritables. And we meet informally every week and write stuff for each other and critique each other and praise each other. And it's been wonderful fun and enormously productive. So big thank you to the Unwritables. Jim. Elspeth wakes. Slumped in the chair, she gropes for her glasses, peers around the living room. Dust motes revolve in the sunlight that filters through the nylon net curtains. Outside, on the walkway, feet echo. Children's voices laugh and shout. Is it 4 o'clock? 5 o'clock. The afternoon is drifting by. The bundle of ragged white feathers on her lap stirs, grunts, fixes her with a beady black eye. I love you, Jim. Elspeth, spine locked always now in a forward bent bow, stoops over the bird in her lap. You lasted the course, Jim. Outran the lot of them. She adjusts her glasses, pushes them up her nose so she can use the bottom of the bifocal lens to see him more clearly. He leans his head into the palm of her hand, fans out his tail with a sensual soft rustle. Her other hand is caught in the dry clasp of one of his four-toed snakeskin feet. His round black eye remains on her face, watching for the moment when she will take her attention away, try and put him down. The big salmon pink crest feathers on top of his head fit softly against her palm. He shifts his balance, croons to her, moves in a trampling circle on her lap, pushing at her hands with his broad grey beak, trying to tuck them underneath him. Once, on a hot railway station platform, Clapham Junction, was it? And long before Jim came into her life, she saw a goitrous male pigeon make those same circling, treading moves. Sitting uncomfortably on her suitcase, sweating in her summer dress, she watched the puffed-up bird approach a sleek female pigeon, pin her down with his scarlet feet, and hug her with his tail, wriggling to a swift climax against her proffered open vent. In 30 years with her, Jim has never achieved so much. At the peak of his ardour, he has occasionally vomited up his semi-digested breakfast of sunflower seeds onto her lap, an offering she's always accepted graciously, not wiping the mess away until he stopped paying court to her and moved away to play elsewhere. Elspeth needs the lavatory now, needs it urgently. She's run out of sanitary napkins and has no margin for error. Rising from the chair is painful, twists her spine and pelvis, and though Jim is lighter than in his younger days, he weighs heavily on her knees. She pushes him onto the floor, and he catches the end of her sleeve and clambers back up her forearm. No, get down, she says sharply, and he flutters awkwardly to the floor, raising his crest so the rosy feathers are fully visible. What do you think you're doing? Stop it! He says, in a reedy travesty of Elspeth's raised voice. I'm not cross, darling, I'm just in a rush, she says. Her legs are weak today, and she holds onto the chair to stand upright. She negotiates her way to the bathroom, by way of the dining table and sideboard, helpless to stop the seeping wetness. But it's not too bad this time. Finally seated on the lavatory, she sees that her trousers are still dry. The pee has not run down her legs and, thank goodness, not reached her slippers. She mops herself with the toilet paper, wads some of it in her knickers to use as a protective pad. Jim has caught up with her, is walking lopsidedly across the bathroom floor, favouring his bad leg. He seizes the shower curtain and pulls himself up, beak over foot, until he is at her eye level. He gives a little warbling grunt, fluffs out his feathers and shakes himself, looking at her expectantly. "No, darling, no shower bath. Not today." She rests her elbows on her knees, shuts her eyes for a moment, and is instantly asleep. The rattle of the shower curtain rings wakes her with a jerk. Jim has climbed right up and is trying to unhook them from the pole. Elspeth wants to stay sitting on the lavatory, sliding into peaceful oblivion, but Jim opens his beak and lets loose a scream. The harsh metallic cry echoes off the tiled bathroom walls, stabs Elspeth's ears. "Hush, hush, hush," she whispers. "Naughty, you know that's naughty." She pulls herself to her feet, drags up her polyester slacks and waits for Jim to climb down to her. Her spine sinks a little further into its hoop as he lands clumsily on her shoulder. "It must be time for tea," she thinks, inching her way to the kitchenette. "The kids have been home from school for ages." A lemon cupcake, that's what she would like. Or a slice of Battenberg, pristine pink and yellow squares on the plate. Hot tea in a china cup. Jim sidles down her arm, swings from the hem of her cardigan and drops to the floor. He skitters over the lino, lopsided as ever, one wing drooping, one leg shorter than the other. Broken decades ago and never properly set. He's aiming for his corner, where she's put a big cardboard box for him. He slides inside it, raises his crest at a provocative angle and hisses at her. "All right, darling, you cuddle up there," she says to him. Her momentary hunger has gone. There's no cake in a shiny box on the worktop, no milk in the fridge. There's a few dusty tea bags in a beige tin marked tea and a Jif plastic lemon in the cupboard. She may not fancy anything now, but Jim needs feeding. The Tupperware box that holds his seeds is empty. When was it last filled up? She finds a tin of vegetable soup in the cupboard, heats it on the stove. Jim loves anything warm. "Unnatural blooming bird," her Bobby used to say. But Jim would always rather share their cooked meals than pick through his dry bird food. "Bobby," she says to herself. The bird rolls his black eye at her and makes a long drawn out noise, somewhere between a smacking, lip squeezing kiss and a whistle. "Yes, darling, Bobby loves you," she says. Does Jim remember Bobby? He must do. He always makes that kissing noise when she says the name. The silly noise Bobby used to make when he picked the bird up and hugged him. He would have been a lovely dad, would Bobby? You could tell that from the way he took Jim on. Loved him right from the start, despite the noise and the mess and the constant demands for attention. It was a shame she was too old for kids by the time she and Bobby got together. Jim sits on her knee to eat, skillfully peeling a soft processed pea and discarding the skin on the side of the bowl, and wolfing his favourite vegetable, potato, until it squeezes out from the sides of his beak. She tries a couple of spoons herself. Gloop, she thinks, but maybe it will give me a bit of energy. Footsteps reverberate on the walkway. The kids are fleeing. Elspeth looks up, sees the hard-faced bitch who has moved in next door walking past. "Face like a smacked ass," thinks Elspeth. The neighbour never smiles. Her downturned mouth, drooping full cheeks and heavy eye makeup remind Elspeth of a concentration camp attendant she saw once on a television documentary. The woman even has her hair pushed back off her forehead in an almost 1940s style. "Hello," calls Jim suddenly, cowering in his box. "Please don't hit me." The woman outside flicks her eyes to Elspeth's kitchen window. Elspeth ducks, even though the nets are there to block prying eyes. "Hush, darling, no one's cross," she whispers. Jim hasn't said those words for a very long time. He must have picked up her fear of the neighbour. When he first came to live with her, after her best friend Emmy rescued him from the man who attacked him with a baseball bat, smashing his wing and leg, before turning on his wife and beating her to death, he used to say it all the time. Emmy, who was a manager at social services, said he must have picked it up from the man's kids. Emmy shouldn't have taken Jim away from that house. It was against social services regulations. But she took pity on the wounded bird and smuggled him home with her. He screamed at and bit everyone except her old friend, Elspeth. When Elspeth called round for tea, Jim went straight to her and climbed onto her shoulder. It was love at first sight. The neighbour is past now. Elspeth hears the snick as her front door closes. Sighing with relief, she goes back to the armchair. She needs to relax, get over herself. Jim hobbles after her, hoists himself into her lap, and with great tenderness caresses the backs of her hands with his beak, tasting her skin with his blunt tongue. She dozes, head falling forward, and then hears the crunch of splintering wood. Jim is chewing on the dilapidated wooden arm of the couch, breaking off chunks of beechwood. No, she grunts at him. What do you think you're doing? That's naughty. Cage for you. He crouches on her lap, tucks his head under the bottom of her cardigan, looks up at her flirtatiously. No, not peepo time, she says. Naughty. The arm of the couch is pretty much ruined. Any more damage and it could fall apart. She pushes Jim away, hustles him across the floor and into his cage under the dining room table. Let me out, he pleads as she pulls the tablecloth over the cage and plunges him into darkness. There's something not right in that flat, says Val, frying bacon in her kitchen. Something quick and easy and tasty for Maxie's tea. I told you, a witch lives there. Maxie is sitting at the table. He's still wearing the tracksuit bottoms and t-shirt he went to bed in last night. He screws up his face at her. A big boy for 11, heavy built, large hands and feet. But going to secondary school has been a shock for him. He's not as tough as he looks. This morning, she let him stay at home when he told her he felt sick. What do you want with this, Maxie? Tomatoes? Mushrooms? Black pudding, he grins, heavy blonde hair flopping forward over his eyes. Don't be silly. Something fresh. Beans. That's not fresh. It's a vegetable. Oh, all right then. Val opens a can of Tesco's own brand. What did you do today? Stuff. Computer games. He makes a face again. So? You'll never be a movie director if you fill up your brain with all of that crap. Maxie snorts at her. What do you know? He says, thrusting his plate at her for the beans. It's the culture of now. She watches him and he stares back at her with her own small blue eyes. He's so sure of his future and yet seems so apart from everything. Not an adult and yet not a teenager either. Not striking quite the right note or saying the right things. She knows he's nervous of the local lads who hang round on the walkway and on the grass in front of the flats. Val turns back to the stove to heat up her Marks and Spencer's gourmet fish pie. Thinks again of the flat next door. Those filthy old nets hanging down, and the windows crusted with dirt, she says. That's so you can't see the witch. I've heard her in there, shrieking. When have you heard this? At night, when I'm in bed. Maxie grins at Val. He knows he's making her feel uncomfortable. Her room is on the other side of the flat, so she hasn't heard anything at night. Does it sound like a child's voice? She asks. No, more like the devil's come to visit, and then the screaming starts. He laughs. didn't you tell me? I wanted to listen. Oh, Maxie, I thought I heard a child in there today saying, don't hit me. Maybe they were doing their rituals. Maxie licks his lips at her. The black arts. He wags his head knowingly. She wonders if she should ban him from using the internet. Or is he just being a normal 11-year-old? Val is exhausted from a long day breathing stuffy, stale air in the office. She needs to go to her room, burn some lavender oil, read a gardening book, and let the tensions of work dispel. But she can't forget the sad little voice she heard. I'm going to go and just knock on the door, she says, leaving her fish pie half eaten on the plate. The neighbouring flat has an old door with blistered paint. There's no sign of a doorbell. The tarnished letterbox with its narrow slot is flush to the wood and there's no knocker. When Val pushes the door, it falls open onto a dark hallway with newspapers piled on a little table. There's a strong smell of urine. Val walks into the kitchenette, her hand to her nose. The floor is covered with shredded cardboard and bits of food which stick to her shoes. She can see several yellow-stained sanitary towels rolled up and tossed in a corner with a pile of empty tins. On the small drop-down table is one bowl of half-eaten food with a spoon in it. The table itself looks as if it's been attacked with a chisel. The edges are chipped and frayed, and there are several deep gouges in the top. There's no sign of a child anywhere. No toys or fish finger packets or brightly coloured plastic beakers. But a child might still live here, Val thinks. Shivering, she makes her way to the lounge, wishing she hadn't eaten the fish pie, which is rising back up into her throat in unstoppable waves. The lounge door is in a similar state to the kitchen table, as if someone had been hitting the top and sides of it with an axe. There are pale coloured splodges all over the floor, and peering in the gloom, Val sees there's some kind of excrement, similar to, though not as dark and rank, as pigeon shit. Val wants to run away. Call social services, pass the buck, get out of this stinking, awful place. But a thin, pathetic voice stops her in her tracks. Let me out! Oh, God! Oh, God, there's a child under the table! A frightened child with some kind of speech defect! It's all right, she says, voice quavering. You're safe now, it's all right. She's frozen to the spot. What should she do? Is there a mad person with an axe hiding somewhere in the flat? Should she go back and tell Maxie to ring the police before she goes any further? Hello? The forlorn voice addresses her again. Are you all right? Shit. No, yes, I am. Are you all right? Have you been hurt? Let me out! The voice is urgent now, louder. Val drops to her knees, dives under the table, feels metal bars under what seems to be a white and red tablecloth. What has she found? What awful abuse is this? Pulling the tablecloth away, she hears a sharp hissing noise, sees a crouching, ghastly white imp with twisted scaly feet and blazing black eyes staring at her. Val screams with the shock, and the imp swells to twice the size and screams back at her with the voice of a soul in torment. It's the agony of twisted metal in a car crash, the whine of a torturer's chainsaw, the lament of a dark angel for the loss of the bright world. Tears spring to Val's eyes as she claps her hands over her ears. Elspeth is dreaming of Bobby. They're walking together under the trees in the park on a bright sunny day, hand in hand, like when they were courting. Then the golden leaf-dappled light shivers and melts as she wakes to Jim's terrible alarm call. Someone has broken in and is trying to steal him. Elspeth splutters, struggles, cannot get out of the chair. Her heart is beating, fit to break out of her body, but for all its efforts, she cannot muster the power to stand up and falls on the carpet. Her glasses have dropped off her nose. She's in a blind blur of fear. It's okay, it's okay. Elspeth is caught in softness and warmth. She's being hugged. It's her mother's hug, tender, encompassing, soothing her aching joints, dispelling her fear. She melts into the embrace. But Jim is still shrieking, warning her, using his full volume to alert her to the danger of a stranger in the flat. She should quiet him. Your glasses. Someone is pressing the plastic frames against her face. Above her, the full drooping face of the woman next door swims into view. Blonde hair hanging down, soft features, like a Virgin Mary in an old painting. She looks sad close to. Elspeth smiles at her. My bird, she says. My Jim. He's ever so jealous.